Hey, sister girls, it's Sheree, the sister girl next door, and I'm back with another interview. So this interview is so special to me because I am a huge fan of the author. And let's just take it back a little bit. In 1993, he dropped the book that probably changed so many lives. Mr. Omar Tyree, when he dropped Fly Girl. Woo! I read the book when I was about probably 11 or 12. I probably shouldn't have been reading the book, but somehow, somewhere, I got my hands on a copy and it blew me away, especially because I was so young. And I think for most Black women who read the book and Black young girls who read the book, it changed their lives, not just because of the content of the story, but the idea that the story was about a Black young girl, and we could see ourselves in the book and in the characters that were in the book. And so 25 years later, we are still celebrating Fly Girl. It's definitely a cult classic in the Black community. So I got a chance to talk to Omar Tyree, and he has so much information, such a wealth of knowledge. And we talked about everything from his early days in West Philadelphia to when he got to college and University of Pittsburgh to when he wrote his first book, because Fly Girl is not his first book. It is his second book. Him being a journalist, writing many books in different genres, and just what he's doing now, what he has coming out, how he feels about Black literature and authors now. He talked about it all. He was very candid. He kept it a buck throughout the whole interview. And I would say, go get your favorite snack, go get your favorite beverage, sit down, and just enjoy the interview. This is not one of those interviews that you could scrub by and just get certain parts, because you will miss something, okay? Be sure to comment, like, subscribe. We're on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram, Sister Girls Book Club. On Twitter, it's Sister Girls BC. And if you want to follow me personally, I'm Sheree Wright on Twitter and The Sister Girl Next Door on Instagram. And the site is thesistergirlnextdoor.com. So without further ado, my interview with Omar Tyree.
Okay, so thank you, Omar Tyree, for giving me your time and just sitting with me to chat about, you know, your book, your writing, what you're up to now. So for those who don't know who you are, which I don't know who doesn't, but just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how did you decide to choose writing as a career?
Well, first I want to thank you guys at the Sisters Book Club for giving me an opportunity to continue talking about my career. You know, sometimes, you know, you can get forgotten in the wind. You know, so many new authors coming out and so many things going on with social media, television and film and sports. And, you know, so some of us authors who used to have a pretty good spotlight in the 90s and the early 2000s, you know, we don't have that same spotlight. So I want to thank you guys first for allowing me to come on the show and talk about what I've done in the book world. So I want to thank you for that.
No problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, if you're asking about how I got started, I'm a Philadelphia native, West Philadelphia. You know, everybody knows that famous line from Will Smith. West Philadelphia, born and raised at the playgrounds where I spent most of my days. I mean, he couldn't have been more authentic. You know, West Philadelphia, which Will Smith will tell you, black on black on black on black. It was a black enclave. And we had a couple white sections where they did not allow you to come. When you cross 63rd Street, white people were ready to kill you. And then at the bottom of West Philly, all the way down to about 34th Street, you know, they had Drexel Campus and University of Pennsylvania was close by there. And you had like a close little melting ground right there before you got into, you know, white enclave down there. But in between 34th Street and 63rd Street, and it's not just street numbers, like you count from 34 to 63rd, sometimes you would skip a street and have like another name in between that street. So we had a good, let's say, 60 blocks of real estate of black people. Mm-hmm. And then it went from like Market Street all the way to Parkside Avenue. So that would be another 20 blocks. So we had like 60 by 20, all them black people in West Philadelphia. And so that's where I was born and raised. And my mother lived in the bottom of West Philadelphia, 38th Street. And my father lived at the top of West Philadelphia, 62nd and Media. So they were right next to the cutoff where white people would try to kill you. And this is Philadelphia, mm-hmm. up in the north. You know, so a lot of times people think you go to the north and, you know, racism is gone. And nowhere in the world is it. You got areas up in Boston, New York, Delaware, Baltimore, D.C., other places where, you know, it's a cutoff between whites and blacks.
And so is that where you started? Like, is that where you started kind of writing and, like, you know, getting your stories and developing your ideas from?
Well, for the most part, black stories was a part of what we were. In Philadelphia, we have what we call row houses, where you live right next door to folks, and it'd be like 30, 40 houses on that block, you know. And then our block had less houses because we had a lot of houses that were burnt up on 38th Street in Austin and West Philadelphia. But all the other blocks would have, like, 50, 60 houses. And you had, like, back in them times in the 70s when I grew up, you had, like, some houses that had, like, 10, 15 people in them. So we literally had, like, 500 people on the block. On your one block, five. Then you go around the other corners, another five. And so I was around all those people. And then I was born in my family tree. My father was the oldest of four, and my mother was the oldest of eight. And so that put me in a situation where I was the young nephew of a lot of aunts and uncles who were not that much older than me. And so they were taking me around and around me in a lot of situations that were adult situations. So I grew up fast, you know, mainly being the firstborn. And so they have studies on the firstborn where you end up getting way more information than the second and third and the fourthborn and all that. So I was like the oldest grandchild, the oldest grandson, the oldest everything. And so when these older folks were dealing with a whole lot of stuff that young people typically aren't around, I was around it. Mm-hmm. And so I picked up a whole lot of stories at a young age where, you know, storytelling for me was easy because I was always around stories and I had big ears to listen to all this stuff. And then I could tell it to the younger, you know, cousins, younger relatives, and even friends who weren't around as many old people as I was. And so I always tell people that's how I end up in a position to become a storyteller, because I was the oldest of the next generation, where I was the bridge between, you know, my mother's family and then, you know, the next generation of cousins and nieces and nephews and all that. And so I'm the big, Omar's like the big uncle, the big cousin, I'm older than everybody in my family for that next generation. And that put me right in the center of storytelling. And then we happen to be a family that loved the movies. We went to the movies religiously. And we had triple features back then where we would go see movies all day long. And I was the youngest again, so my uncles, Monte and Andre, were my main two uncles that would take me to the movies all the time. And we used to watch kung fu movies back then in the 70s. And, you know, they would get money from my mom, who was the oldest. And then they would take me to the movies all day long. And I would go in there and memorize the movies, memorize the lines, memorize the scenes. And my uncles would get a kick out of it because I would talk about the movie and, you know, verbatim. Mm-hmm. And my uncles, like, he didn't memorize that one movie.
So when did you first, like, pin your first book? Like, when did you first, like, with all the storytelling and stuff, pin your first story or essay?
Black people are vocal. Mm-hmm. They're vocal people. So I wasn't writing nothing down. People, you always just write. I wasn't writing a daggone thing. I was speaking, you know, and doing voices and all that kind of stuff and telling stories. But when I got to college, you know, they wanted to see where your writing skills were. And so they asked you to write, and your assignments were, write about your family, your home, something you got involved in, your hobbies, your friends, and all that. And I was like, really, you want me to write about Philadelphia? And I went to the University of Pittsburgh. So I went out to Pitt, which is, you know, 4 to 6 hours, depending on how fast you drive, from Philadelphia to the west side, which is Pittsburgh, all the way on the west side of Pennsylvania. And so I went out there, and that was an assignment for college. And at that point, again, I was a vocal storyteller, but now you wanted us to write it down. And I was like, okay. So when I wrote it down, I had all the details. I had all the sound effects. I had all the voices. I had all the dialogue. All the stuff that naturally becomes storytelling. I had been doing that for years vocally. But now I wrote it down, and then they wanted us to read it in front of our peers because, you know, they wanted to see how we read and wrote. And so when I read my stuff in front of my peers, they were like, man, your stuff sound like we right there, man. Your stuff got to be, you got sound effects, you got, you know. So then the teachers were like, hey, man, can we get you to do a student diary? And so as a freshman at the University of Pittsburgh, I was writing a diary about the things I was getting involved in on campus as a freshman. And we had everybody read my diary, and they printed in like a newspaper thing in the Pitt. And so we had sophomores, juniors, and seniors reading my diary stuff, and then I passed into the highest level of English as a freshman. And then I had, you know, a lot of juniors and seniors asking me to help them with their writing assignments. So when it got to that point, I was like, yo, I'm pretty good at this writing stuff. And so that was it. You know, my freshman year of college, I said, yo, I'm going to keep doing this writing stuff. And I got challenged one time by a dude from Pittsburgh that went to school with us. His name was Michael Quigley. And I had a speak out. Every time we had speak outs or, you know, events where we were talking and whatnot, and people raised their hands to speak, I always had something to say. And I was like one of them dudes that always had something to say. And so Mike Quigley challenged me one time. He said, man, you got so much to say about everything. You need to write a book or something. And when he said that, it was a jam-packed room, like 300 of us, 200 or 300 of us. You know, all black students, you know, sophomores and freshmen and whatnot. I think I was a sophomore by that time. And so I stepped up to the challenge, like, yeah, man, I'm going to write me a book. I'm going to go ahead and do that. And when I did that, again, this was 1988, somewhere around there. And so all my peers look at me like, yo, you said you're going to write a book. We weren't writing books back then. You know, you're talking about, what's that, Alice Walker with The Color Purple, and we're talking about Roots from Alice Haley. You know, we didn't have a whole lot of books back. That's before Terry McMillan and all this new book started coming out. And so when I said I was going to write a book at 18, 19 years old, you know, my friends were like, whoa, you said you're going to write. They were shocked that I would step up to the plate. But I was already doing stories, so it was just going to that next level of writing them down as opposed to speaking them.
So, like, flash forward to, like...
Started early on.
So flash forward to, like, 1993 when... What was, like, the publishing landscape, the writing landscape for black writers when you came out with Fly Girl? So when that actually hit, did it make an instant impact where everybody ate it up? Or was it, like, did it build over time?
Yeah, it built over time. At that time, 1989, I think, 88, Terry McMillan did one of those books, Mama. And then she had a little momentum. And then she did Disappearing Acts, like, 90, 91. And a lot of people were talking about that, so I went and got Disappearing Acts and read that. I was like, yo, this is a good book. And at that time, we had that one book, What Looks Like the Rainbow for Colored Girls. And it's like a poetry type
book for colored girls.
And a lot of girls read that. And then we had a lot of nonfiction books about black history and black culture. A lot of Afrocentric books were coming out in the early 90s. And so most of our stuff was nonfiction. And then we had that famous book that had a whole lot of black women up in arms when Shahrazad Ali put out The Black Woman's Guide to Understanding, you know, Black Man's Guide to Understanding the Black Woman, where she had one page a day where she talked about sometimes black women got too much mouth. Man might have to smack her back, smack them. It really went crazy. And she was on an Oprah Winfrey show. People don't remember. Oprah had shows where she talked about books way back in the early 90s. And so Shahrazad Ali was on her show talking about that. And that book sold, man, like hundreds of thousands of copies. And it had a lot of black bookstores were in business because of that book. It helped them to get an audience. And so I just came through in the early 90s when black books were starting to pick up. And then when Terry McMillan published Waiting to Exhale, I think Alice Walker had a book on the top 10 of New York Times bestsellers. And then Toni Morrison. And so it was historical. Three black women had New York Times best-selling books on the list at the same time. And that just fertilized the soil for young black writers to come after them. And I was the youngest at the time. And Fly Girl was my second book. My first book was a book called Colored on White Campus, which I put together while at the University of Pittsburgh, dealing with the whole racial identification and racial information that you get once you become a college student. And again, I was coming from West Philadelphia, which is blacker than black, and then I ended up going to a college where, you know, we like 3% of the population. You know what I mean? So it was like not really culture shock because I was in my own skin very comfortable, but it was like, wow, we don't get a chance to go to college. And we really understood that. Like, damn, black people not really going to college like that. You know what I mean? But, you know, understood that, like, wow, we're not getting these opportunities like we really should have in this country. So then you understood how race proliferated itself and locked black people out because you didn't get opportunities to get an education, you know, like a lot of white folks did.
So when you were, so like, so
book.
I guess and around
Fly Girl was second.
Okay. Yeah, I know that part because I was just like, well, when you went to write Fly Girl, what made you decide to kind of choose a girl? If this was your second novel, why didn't you take the stance? I guess from a male's perspective, especially seeing how the landscape was so heavily dominated by Black women, like you said, on the New York Times bestseller list, and just like there were so many women writing about other Black women. What made you say, okay, I'm going to be writing about a young Black girl, you know what I mean? Instead of like what was the inspiration behind that?
The first book was already about a boy. You know what I mean? So people forget that Colored on White Campus was already from the male perspective. So I didn't write from a girl's perspective. But here's what happened. When I was taking creative writing classes, we had to do characters. That was one of the things that I was most astute at. You had to study characters. So you had to jump outside your skin. Write about a grown man. I was only like 18, 19 years old. So you had to write about a grown man, write about a farmer, write about a Mexican, write about a white person, write about a woman. So that was part of the writing process. So you're just not writing about yourself all the time. You had to write about other people to really be a writer, to understand another person's perspective. If you're going to write characters, you have to be able to do that. And so for me, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, we were chasing girls all the time. So it was natural to say, okay, I'm going to write about the kind of girls that we chased, which we called them fly girls, that were these extracurricular, you know, dress girls, and, you know, high class, high culture, and beautiful, you know, that we grew up with. And by that time, I had moved from West Philadelphia to an area called Mount Airy in Philadelphia. And it was a great move up. All the Black people had moved on up, but you had to be able to afford it. And so we had Black people that moved up. And a lot of times when Black men move up, they marry women that look better. They pay for the women the whole night. I hate to sound superficial, but let me tell you something. Black people will tell you in Philadelphia, when you move up to Germantown and Mount Airy and West Oak Lane, man, the girls up that joker, because they have families that have more money, so now they can pay for their hair and their nails and their dress code. And so when you went up there, boy, you like, oh my God, I have landed in the Amazon of Black fine women, boy. And so we had guys coming from all over the other parts of Philadelphia to get girlfriends up in Mount Airy. And so that was the soil that started Fly Girl. And we had a song called Fly Girl from a group called the Boogie Boys out of Brooklyn, New York, that was very popular in 1985. And so I coined the book off of that Fly Girl song, Fly Girl. And I had the double Y. I always use double Y because we don't say fly and quit. It's long, fly. You know, we stretch it. And so it had that double Y, probably a triple Y, but I didn't want to overdo it. So the double Y to make sure you get that it's fly. You know, we stressed it. You know, that girl fly. That means that she had the jewelry, the gear, the attitude.
Yeah, we still say fly. You know, we still say fly. You know, in our generation too, and that lets you know like what type of dress code and how she looks. You'd be like, oh, that's fly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I totally get it.
But, you know, the young people don't use it anymore.
They still use fly. They'll say fly. They say lit now, but like I guess millennials, when you say fly, you still know exactly what we know exactly what you're talking about as far as like dress or the hair or something like that. We might not use it every single day, but it is a word that's still, I guess, used to signify that something is really nice or, you know, something that we really like. So
I always talk about language because that's one of the things I'm into. But fly for me is to elevate, you know, to stand above, to shine, to, you know what I mean, like a bird. The fly in the buttermilk was the term we used to use earlier than that, you know, super fly. You know what I mean? It really is to elevate. I'm going to elevate above it. Whatever I'm around, I'm higher. You know what I mean? So it's that whole elevation.
So when
that's
the book,
what I always explain to people.
When the book came out, did you ever receive any backlash because you wrote about urban life and because you kind of had like this young girl
something.
Going through like adult situations and it was like,
let me tell you something. The first review I had was the guy reviewed Fly Girl in the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is my hometown newspaper. And this brother started talking about, you know, I was being opportunistic and going after the women's audience and all that. And I just told you, like, I had learned that you want to write characters so you're not writing from your perspective all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I just happened to luck up and write about the kind of girls that we chase. And I was a helpless romantic. I was very much in the girls. Trust me, I was very much in the girls, boy. I'm talking about, so I was one of those dudes that was sweet on women. So it was natural for me to write about a girl that just had my attention like that. But this dude had this whole idea that I was opportunistic and I was just, you know, trying to hawk off the women readership. And I was pissed. I mean, this dude don't know me. I've written all kind of characters. You got a lot of boys in it. It's actually more boys in the Fly Girl book than girls, but a lot of people aren't counting on the boys that I have in there. You just give me credit for the girls. But it's not like the girls in there by themselves. Some of these dudes don't know what he's talking about. I'm from Philadelphia. I'm writing about my own culture, what we grew up in. He talking about I'm being, I was hot. You know, my wife was like, calm down. You're going to have some reviews that ain't, you know, ain't got you. Calm down. But I was more pissed because it was a Philadelphian dude doing that. When I grew up in that city, like, dude, how you going to tell me I'm being out there? Nobody wrote about this city like I was. You know, I was hot. Like, you need to be looking at me and celebrating the fact that I wrote about Philadelphia cause to try to say, you know, so I was hot. And then with the school systems, since I wrote about the truth of, you know, sexuality and all that, you know, the school system, like, we can't have our girls reading this book and all that. Because I was a college student when I wrote it. So when you're on college campus, think about it. We having sex, we in dorm room. So you at the mature level. So I'm not thinking about, I got a hot sex. I said, yeah, we would have some girls that everybody would have sex. But you have some girls that were, mm-hmm. but you were trying to get it. You definitely were trying to get some dudes as a teenager. So I'm like, I don't know what city you went, but every teenager was trying to get. And then you had girls that was, no, I'm not ready for that. I don't want to do. And you had some girls that would give it up. That's just human. It's natural. And so I'm like, yo, I didn't lie in the book. But some teachers and some parents were like, well, I hear a little racy in this book. I was like, yo, once you stop it, you and some of the girls that you knew were giving it up, you may have been giving it up. And so I'm like, no, I'm not going to lie in the book. It told the truth. And that's why so many of the young girls, they gravitated to it because it was so honest and truthful about, they had never read books like that because typically you would, you know, try and shy away from, you know, or from an adult perspective. I don't want to put that in there. I don't want to do that. But I was 18, 19 when I started writing. So I didn't have that thing of, I'm going to hide this. I'm like, yo, this is what we did. I'm not going to hide anything. And so I didn't really get a backlash coming at me. But, you know, you had school systems and parents who were like, well, I can't, you can't read this book. You're not. And so some girls would talk about having to hide to read the book or read the book where they got 15 and 16. But I would always say that once you turn 13, open that fly girl up because you're not going back down. You're going up. And most of the girls that read the book, it served as an opening eye of what they should be looking for and how they should approach things. And it made them actually smarter. A lot of times, you know, you have the parents thinking, well, she might try to have sex. No, them girls will read the book and understand exactly what you're getting involved in if you cross that line. And so it made them a lot more, mature about the process. And then let me tell them, they had, like, student assignments. They would get straight A's off of Fly Girl because they was really locked in. But typically, if they get you to read a book that you don't like, you barely read the book, so mm-hmm. you ain't locked in if they ask you questions. Man, they averaged an A on Fly Girl. Every girl that I wrote a report about Fly Girl and got an A. That's the first A I ever got in English, ever got, because they was locked in on that book. And so the book actually made them a lot more smart and heady and mature about it, and they love it, you know what I mean? So it was very lucky for me to write from a girl's perspective because girls read more than guys. I wasn't thinking about that at the time, but if I had not written Fly Girl, I don't know if I'd had a career if I was just writing boy books because boys weren't reading and girls would rather read about themselves than the boys like that. Mm-hmm. And so I just lucked up to know that you have to move around with your characters. And I moved into a young girl story in Philadelphia and I was very lucky to be that, man. It's knock on wood that that actually opened up a career because I've written so many books now where people haven't read. I feel that they're all good books, but they keep coming back to Fly Girl because it represents them so well. You know what I mean? The story that no one ever told about the young girl in an urban city.
So after the success of Fly Girl, how did you choose the direction of your writing after that? Because like you said, you've written many books in different genres. You've written children's books, young adult books. You've written adult books. You've written urban novels. You've written contemporary, like kind of on the edge of like contemporary romance. So how did you choose, like right after that, you know, because you did a follow-up to Fly Girl. So how did you choose to, okay, say, this has been so successful, you know, why not keep a good thing going? What made you say, I'm going to choose different genres and write about a variety of characters, even though you knew the success rate of Fly Girl?
Well, when I started being a storyteller, I'm not trying to write one story. Even when I went to the movies, I saw horror movies, I saw sports movies, I saw comedies, I saw kung fu movies, I saw cartoon movies. I watched everything. So as a storyteller, you know, I went to parties, I got in fights, I played football, I chased girls. These are different types of stories, different types of characters. Mm-hmm. So to be honest with you, I have been bored writing the same. I'm not going to write 20 Fly Girl books. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yo, I got other stuff I want to talk about. I got other stuff I want to say. And So a lot of people get caught up in, oh, but this is your audience. You got to write for your audience. I'm like, look, dude, if my audience can't accept the stories I want to tell, then that's not really my audience. Mm-hmm. Now, you're a fly girl audience. You're not an Omar Tyree audience. If you want to hear stories, let me tell them the next story mm-hmm. about a different thing, about some other city, about some other people. And so I continue to have stories that interest me. And after I wrote the Fly Girl book, I'm like, I did it already. I'm not going to keep coming back. But I did do the sequel because they kept asking about it. And so I think like 7 years later, I went and wrote the sequel. And then another 5 years later, I went and wrote a trilogy. Mm-hmm. Because again, yeah, economically speaking, you knew. And that's why the Fly Girl book, the sequel was called For the Love of Money. Because I wanted to teach a lesson about when you start doing art just for money because you know the audience is there, you're cheating yourself about creativity. That's not real creativity. You're just trying to give people what they want. But that's not real art. Now you're making a business decision.
Wow.
And so I said, all right, I'm going to come back.
Sorry, not to interrupt you, but I never knew that you like wrote, because I read For the Love of Money when I was really young. So I never knew that the title of that book was
For the Love of Money. Because I had that struggle. I wanted to write new artwork, but everybody just come to write another. So I said, all right. But at the twist of that book, is she not in the hood? She grew up. She's wiser now. She's mature.
She was older.
Then I had her go out to Hollywood creating new stuff, and a lot of girls were pissed off at me. How come you didn't have her marry Victor? I said, ain't no way in the world this girl going to go to school and then wait for some dude to get out of jail. That didn't make no sense. I went to black schools, the Howard University. I was around Hampton. And more at Morgan State and Coppin. And there's no way in the world it's disrespectful to us black men who went to college with these girls to have a girl graduate from Howard or Hampton or wherever, waiting for some dude to get out of jail. When you went to school with brothers who were getting educations and doing the right thing, you mm-hmm. know how disrespectful that is? And you going to diss me and wait for some dude to come out of jail to marry him? I said, that's ridiculous. And even a Muslim brother, he changed himself while there in jail. I said, look, that didn't make no sense. You're going to be waiting for me. You got to move on. We ain't kids no more. And so I had to pretty much, you know, wake sisters up. Like, you love Fly Girl because it was real. It was honest. Now you want me to write a fantasy about an educated girl that's going to actually wait for it. Now, I'm not saying that can never happen, mm-hmm. but 90% of the time, once you go to college, you see other brothers that's doing the right thing. You ain't waiting for some dudes in jail, that, you know. And so, yeah, I had to wake them up and give them a wake-up call. But a lot of them were pissed off because they wanted a ghetto story tale. You know, I'm like, hey, man, come on, now stop that. She went to college, she's going to keep it moving, you know. And so I had to wake up a lot of girls. And then she was a poet, so I had the poetry in there, which was mm-hmm. quite creative and clever for me to write from a girl's perspective on poetry. But again, I'm going to say it again, one of the lessons that we learn in creative writing, can you write from another person's perspective? And I do that very well, which proves that I'm at that next level. You have to be able to do that if you're going to write books that's not about yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's all it is, you know. But I get more credit for the female characters than I do for the males. I've written tons of male characters, but I guess since I'm a guy, you just blow that off like, oh, well, of course you're a guy. Okay, but I'm not from the South. I'm not from the West. I'm not an Army dude, but I can write about all these dudes and I research them. I get it right. I'm an A student. I want to get it right. But I don't get credit for those. So we keep talking about how I write these great, strong female characters while ignoring all the men in them same books. All those books you talk about have men in them, you know, so it's funny that way. But at this point, I'm like, all right, you just take it out of the game, like how it comes, and mm-hmm. you deal with it. But, yeah, I try to write a lot of different characters because I'm interested in a lot of different things. And you find out that a lot of people are not. They want to read the same stuff over and over again, you know. So now as an older writer, I understand that, but I'm not going to let you pigeonhole me or lock me into just writing what you want, because I got a lot of other interests, and mm-hmm. I would not be able to write just what you want, because that would bore me. I would not have the energy and the passion to keep writing what you want all the time. It's not going to happen.
So you were publishing books before, like, the boom of the internet and, like, independent publishing, because now there's so many black independent authors, black independent publishing companies owned by black people. And so do you think now more black stories are able to be told and become popular because of the open market, or do you think it's harder to actually stand out now because it's so many independent black authors who can just kind of, like, write their book and have their book out next month? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a both things are happening. I would always give the example, when we were selling a lot of books, it's because we had stars. We had star authors. And so this is what would happen. When we had those bookstores, when Terry McMillan came out with a book and she did a book signing, all kind of people would show up at the store, 200-300 people. Now, when they came in to buy her book, there's other books in there. So they would look on the shelf and buy other people's books. But once you had to have that traffic for that to happen. But if you don't have any superstars that bring you to the store to make you get up and go to the store to find the other book, now you're not going to the store. There's nobody there to go to the store for. So now all the books suffer because you don't have superstars. So I used to tell people that I understand you got all these different authors, but you have to have superstars. It's just like on the highway, you got that fast lane on the left. If everybody's driving the same speed, you know how it is on the highway when a cop gets in front of everybody and he's driving 65 miles an hour and now everybody slows down. It doesn't it jam up the entire daggone road for miles and you're like, what's going on? You got a cop sitting there doing 65. Somebody has to do 70 and 80 to loosen up the highway. But now you all sitting behind the cop because you don't want to get a ticket, right? You've never seen that where everybody sits behind a cop. It jams up the whole highway. Well, that's what you have now. When you don't have stars, when you don't have those big book signers, when you don't have those super books, it slows up everything. Now you got a road jam. Now the books aren't selling the way they used to. You don't have everybody getting excited like they used to. And it ends up not benefiting the people in the long run. So you got more content out there, but you got less people excited about superstar authors. You know what I mean? So that's the catch-22. And so at one point, I knew, I said, man, there's too many authors coming out. I'm not hating on them. I'm not trying to stop them from doing that thing, but I still have to elevate as a star above them. I felt that way because somebody has to stand out for everybody else to be able to sell their work. Otherwise, people, I'm not really selling none of these new books. And if they start getting like, and that's why all the books started shutting down, closing up, and you don't have the same traffic and excitement for books. And then reality stars started coming out and TV started taking over, and you don't go to the bookstores anymore. Now you talk about, what's the hottest book out? Oh, I don't know. We always had a hot book. Every month we had a hot book coming out from Evelyn Harris and Eric Jerome Dickey and Terry McMillan and, you know what I mean, Sister Soldier. Every month we had a hot book coming out. Now it's not like that. You got too many authors. People don't even know their names now. Oh, the book about the growing up. They don't even know the author's name. So you needed a Zane to come out. You need authors that have names that push people to the store and get them excited. And without having that, you can write all the books you want. We're not making the same money off of books, you know. And so I started pushing for movies really hard, really strong, because movies, if you're all stuck on the highway, think about it now. I don't care if I'm sitting in a Rolls Royce. My book can be better than everybody. It doesn't matter. I'm still sitting in that jammed up highway with people trying to make a decision. A lot of times it was about pricing. Omar's book cost $24 for a hardback. I ain't buying no hardback. I can get three books now for $24. And that's what they were doing, bragging about other people's books. Now, that hurt me as a superstar author. Now my numbers go down. Now Hollywood's like, oh, well, this story must ain't good because it didn't sell the same numbers. Now I'm hurt. I can't get the Hollywood stuff. Man, it messed up everything. I'm like, man. And I'm not hating on the other authors, but I'm like, it messed up that natural trajectory of these other authors that were already leading the way of getting these film deals and everything else. And so I should have been had movie deals done with my books, which would, again, elevate everyone else's book, because now you're like, wow, Omar's book really inspired me. What's the next book? You know what I mean? It automatically makes you think about that next book in line. But if none of us get the film deal, then none of us get the, you know, to elevate to that next level. And
but don't I've been you
trying
think,
to get film deals since the early 2000s, man, and I'm still hungry to get it. And that would have given me the helicopter to raise above, you know what I mean, to be a superstar again where, you know, you shine again for the book. And once those film deals happen, then you can start looking at my other books, my Leslie book, my Just Say No book, my Diary of a Groupie book, the Sweet St. Louis book. So many great stories that would be great films for black people that didn't do the numbers because I'm competing against so many up-and-coming authors. But that's just the way it goes. So I'm not complaining about it. I'm just telling what it is. It ends up holding down a whole lot of that energy that we had when we had stars in the 90s.
But I think, I mean, I'm not saying I disagree. Well, I guess I am saying I disagree a little bit, just because I'm like, there's so many black authors who are now able to kind of be their own bosses and have their entrepreneurial spirit and create their own companies, because a lot of publishing companies are run by white people who have not tapped into the idea that, oh my God, this author is really good and that they can bring in that crowd. So it's like, just like back in the day and even now, when they won't let you in a door, you create your own door and you create your own building. So with the internet and like companies that are like Amazon and everybody else that are like publishing these stories, or you can get your story out there. Whereas before, like back in the 90s, it would be so hard. So I get the idea that it's so many authors, but I think I would have to say it kind of would be a good thing, because now you have a community. Whereas before, I don't really remember. I was young, so I could be very wrong, where it would be like events held just for Black authors, panel discussions just for Black authors. And I mean, not just for like the five Black authors that are really popular. And if you weren't in college, I'm talking about like literally being a 35-year-old woman or a 45-year-old woman and going to an event specifically for Black authors and buying their books and stuff. I'm only saying that because we have our own event as well. And I see so many events like that, that are catered to Black authors. Whereas if you only have like five or four, how else can anybody else get in? Like, you get what I'm saying? So I'm like, I agree what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, but I'm like, at the same time, I think that the internet kind of helped, you know, it helped like the girl who's 18 and she could really write, but maybe she's not, you know, have the money or the access. With the internet, she now has that access. You get what I'm saying?
Okay, well, first off, I never said that I would stop them from publishing.
No, not stopping them. I'm just saying that it would be a good thing, I guess, to have more people in the market.
Yeah, that's fine. Again, I don't stop them. Get your hustle, get your story out there. But my thing was that when those numbers start to decrease, the numbers of the stars, you got to understand what that does, where now if you have the Black Panther movie that came out and did $1 billion, that helps every Black movie. But if you are doing like 20 million, they're like, oh man, this money was. Now they're looking at, you may have more Black films, but now you can't get the bigger money to do the big films. So now we're all forced to do self publishing. Now some of the authors who had those bigger deals, they cut us loose, and now we're doing self publishing again. And so, again, in the long run, I'm not trying to stop people from getting in and writing new books. Keep doing it. But my thing was, it became even more important for those authors who already have spotlight and name recognition to get that next level, which was the film. And then again, you come through and get a best great, but that needed that elevation. So again, I hear what you're saying, but that's why now we have so many events. What you're talking about now, I do an author's event, and it's 50 authors there and only 100 people. But that's a problem. Mm-hmm. The opposite of what you were saying, we had 500 people and four authors. Do you know what's going to happen? Each author now is going to stand out and make good money. Now I'm going to an event where you got 50 authors and it's only 100 people in there, and now none of the authors are exciting anybody to come with 500 people, and now everybody's fighting over the little money that you get. It's ridiculous. But that's what happens in an open market, and that's why you have a lot of conglomerates who want to squash that thing so they can really make some real money. So I hear what you're saying, but again, that's what started a downgrade of the super Black author that we used to have when we can't get the numbers that we used to get. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying that that's part of that regime that happened. The white author still can get that number. The John Greshams, the, the Stephen Kings, the Nora Roberts, they still get that number, and that still that they can still push people to the store. If we can't have the Terry McMillans and the Toni Morrison and Eric Jerome Dickies and the Michael Bays and Omar, if we still can't draw that audience, then everybody ends up hurting from it. And that's what we have now. We do a lot of events where we don't have the same support from the community that we used to have. They're not excited like they used to be. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but at the end of the day, you're proving that point again. When we had superstars, people came. They was happy to take pictures. They knew who we were. Now it's too many authors to even know who the people are now. You know, so they're not getting excited for that.
So what advice?
If you look at the internet, it's about the numbers game now. If you don't have the numbers, they're like, you're just a bunch of regular people. So I'm not hating about them getting it in. I'm just saying you still have to have those stars no matter what, because the stars end up benefiting everybody's hustle.
So what advice can you give new and aspiring authors, whether it's business or writing advice? Because you said a lot. So what about the new kids on the block that's trying to come up, or they're either, you know, trying to be that superstar author, they're trying to get into writing or trying to get their first book out, what advice would you have to give to them, business-wise or writing-wise, either way?
Well, I always tell writers that, you know, the simplest thing, write is write. And I say that because you have a lot of people that say, I always wanted to be a writer. I've been thinking about being a writer. You know, how could I become a writer? And I'm like, oh, you write? You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. What are you thinking about? Write. You know, what are you planning? Write. You know, is this, you got to do it to learn how to do it. Mm-hmm. Read other people's stuff. Write your stuff. Share your stuff. Do poetry. Start your short story. Start your novel. It's not going to start itself. So this is the simplest thing I tell writers all the time. I didn't become a writer by thinking about it. I became a writer by writing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you got to write. You got to do what you want to do. And then you become a better writer by now writing and reading what you wrote and proving it. You know, then you can take some courses. And I have what I call a consultation program I've been doing since 2008. You guys can email me at omar8tyree@aol.com. And I send you the breakdown for my consultation. I now have 63 clients that I've helped to get published and everything else. And so with the people that get serious, you know, I don't do the mentor thing because I got too much going on where, you know, I can give, you know, quick advice. But for the most part, I do the consultation where you locked in and it's a contract that we do where I'm helping you all the time. Mm-hmm. But the mentor thing, it's like, nah, if you want to get in this business, it's a business. You got to take it seriously. Put your money where your mouth is and get serious about it. Otherwise, if it's a hobby, I'm not mentoring on the hobby level because this is still a profession. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like, nah, you want to be a professional, then come in as a professional. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, if a hobby thing, go to some schools, you know, take writing courses at community college. And I tell people that all the time, just to get your feet wet in it and learn what you're doing and read other people's content. You have to read other people's stuff so you understand how quality writing is done and how many different styles of writing you can do. And that's why I have so many different styles as well. I read a lot of different content, not just fiction, not just nonfiction, not just slavery work, not just, you know what I mean? You read a whole lot of stuff. Science fiction, Octavia Butler's Wild Seed was my most favorite book. You know, it's a science fiction, you know, black superhero kind of, you know, mystery kind of, you know, supernatural book. But it's excellent, you know. So I read a whole lot of different authors. But that's the main thing. You have to write if you want to be a writer. You know, you can't play basketball without playing basketball. You can't be a football player without playing football. You can't be a doctor without learning and practicing medicine. So a writer has to write. That's what you have to do.
And what about the business aspect of it? Because I think I think writers and creatives, they never talk about the business aspect, or they never probably take into account that after the writing, you have to now become a businesswoman or a businessman and kind of handle the finances, the marketing, and all of that other stuff, the back end. So do you have any advice on that aspect? Or can you speak about that?
Well, you know, you can look at a regular accounting book and understand that I got to keep this money in the bank, flip it over, how to measure it out and whatnot. You know, so with something like that, you're just talking about pure business. You know, you go to any business book that you can pick up. You already reading and writing books. You know, go to the business corner of the bookstore and just look at business 101, savings and accounts. You know what I mean? And say, okay, I have to save this money. And you learn how to do that. That's just natural, you know, adulthood and hustling and making money and learning how to stretch that money out and provide for your family and the whole nine, you know. But over the last 10 years, you know, with the economy going down and the bookstores closing up, a whole lot of book sellers, particularly from the black industry, you know, black industry of bookseller, we haven't had that same, you know, sales momentum and establishment that we used to have. You know what I mean? So a lot of us are learning how to tighten up the budget and figure out new ways of publishing books and competing with books. And so I'm doing a lot of those new things too, including the e-books that you put out now, because the physical books can be, you know, a task to print now and then have to get your money back after print. And then distribution is not as open as wide sellers used to be because you got less stores. You know, so now you're looking at other means of putting books out there and selling the books. And so that's just a part of changing business. But yeah, you know, business 101, saving and budgeting and understanding what to do with the money that comes in and goes out. You know, that's just a human thing. That's not even just a book thing. That's any business.
So what's one thing you wish you knew before you started your career as an author?
Okay, say that again.
What's one thing you wish you knew before starting your career as an author?
What advice before starting a career as an author? That first
point? What's one thing you wish you knew before starting your career? Okay. Yeah.
Well, I learned everything. The one thing I complain about is the publicity. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're an author, you're not looked at as sexy as a television star or an athlete or a musician. You know, so it's hard for us to get the publicity that other people get in the entertainment field because we're looked at as more educational, intellectual, and a lot of times a lot of writers are more introverted. So they don't have that charming, lively, extroverted personality that people want on a radio show or a television program or in a print interview. And so you have to be more colorful in your personality, wear more colorful things, be a character to attract these type of things. And sometimes with writers, they're more introspective where they're not extroverted. And so I talk about that in my consultations. You have introverted and extroverted personality. I'm actually an introvert as well. But when I do interviews and I'm out there selling a book, I become extroverted because I know I have to turn on, you know, that light of charm and character and talking. So a lot of people, oh, Mar, you talk a lot. Yeah, because I'm turned on now when I have to talk about my book. And so I've always understood that that has to happen as a part of selling. Because a lot of times I would go into book interviews and they would tell me right before we go on air, I didn't get a chance to read the book. What's the book about? And I'm like, what are you believe? And so I said, don't worry about it. I got you. And they just asked me one question, and I just talk about everything about that book, and then it would become easy for them. And so I learned how to over-talk everything, because if you don't, you're sitting there in dead space. Oh, I wrote the book because I wanted to talk about my grandmother. Dead space. Okay, so what did you write? And then you got it out, and then it looks like that bag one used to have a comedy skit on Saturday Night Live where they had public radio. So they had these white women with this boring, extra boring conversation. And so that's how a lot of media people feel about authors. You're going to have these boring interviews and nobody wants to listen to them. And so that's been the hardest thing. But going in, you know, I wasn't thinking about it that way, but I've never been a boring interview, so it didn't affect me once I got the interviews. But they do think of us that way, where we're going to be boring interviews. But, you know, as long as you lively and you, Terry McMillan has never been a boring because she's crazy. She's just outright. Terry is liable to say anything. She has that attitude about her. And so Terry has always been an engaging interview because of her attitude and her body language. You know what I'm saying? You don't know what's going to come out of that. But if you are a Toni Morrison type or an Alice Walker type, who are both introverted personalities, and even to a certain degree, Maya Angelou, you know, who can be a very analytical talker. You know, sometimes it's like you have to have patience even to listen to those type of interviews where it's a long-winded kind of thing. Even me, I got to learn how to cut down my answers. You don't hear all that talk. But that's what we tend to do as authors. So that's one thing that I would look at. How can we become sharper media people, knowing that the world wants quick, fast answers and all this excitability and gossip? Because us authors, we write about people. We're not trying to put our stuff out there, if you notice. Terry McMillan was one of the few that had her stuff out there. But the rest of us authors, we typically keep our home life at home. And we write about other things we want to talk about. And so, yeah, we become less, hot news, hot topic news people. You know, so that's the one thing I would say about authors.
So as a writer, you can spend a lot of time in solitude. How did you balance, or how do you balance your real life with the fictional ones that you create?
Right, that's easy. I mean, I'm a journalist, so those characters I create don't touch me at all. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And really, they're created off the topics. I'm a journalistic writer, so I always write from the topic. What do I want to deal with as a topic? And then I create the characters from that. And so every single one of my books have been created from a topic, not really the character. If I want to write about black love, I got a black man and a woman. Let me create the characters because I want to write about black love. When I wrote about the music world with Just Say No, let me create a character that fits this book in Just Say No. When I wrote about Leslie and black poverty and crime and voodoo and all that, let me create a character who fits that voodoo spookiness of New Orleans, which I love New Orleans. And so every time I write a book, I create characters who fit that particular book. Those characters don't walk around with me and all that. No, I don't do that. So this character walked up and smacked me in it. You hear, you know, walking, talking like that. I'm not one of them dudes, you know. My characters are created based off the book that I'm writing. But when I do it, like I said earlier, I'm very good at breaking down the psychology and sociology of people. So when I do it, it feels real because because I'm not going to create something that's fake. I have to make it as real as possible every single time.
So, okay, a couple of weeks ago on the Shade Room, I know you probably visited Instagram. It's a popular, you know, I guess, gossip site for celebrities and stuff. It was a meme posted, you know, about Fly Girl being like, we didn't have to have reality shows because we had these books, like The Coldest Winter Ever, and your book Fly Girl was up there. So with it being like the 25th anniversary of the book, are you surprised by like the success that it still holds today, that so many people are still interested in it being turned into a movie, or they can remember the character so vividly? And a lot of us, especially me, I read that as a really, really young girl, probably like I was like maybe 11. I was really young. So are you surprised that it's still like so successful, or has become a like cult classic for our community?
Realistically, I wanted to have a movie for Fly Girl years ago. Mm-hmm. So to be honest with you, I expected not only Fly Girl, but my other books as well to be way bigger than what they are right now, because I wanted to have films where the people that hadn't read those books, like Leslie, who was my favorite character, like Just Say No, which is my favorite book, like Sweet St. Louis, which is a great black-on-black love story, like Pecking Order, which is a great black business book. You know what I mean? A lot of these daggone books I would love for people to read more of, but the films would take them to the next level where they're sleeping on the books. And so I've kind of forgotten about Fly Girl because I've had to do other things mm-hmm. that keep my name out there, and trying to do music, trying to do other books, trying to do films of my own, short stuff, all kind of stuff to keep my name out there. But, you know, if Fly Girl would have been, you know, adapted into a film years ago, then that thing would have elevated beyond where it is right now. And so this 21st year anniversary, I came out with it in 93, which makes it exactly 25 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to put out a new book. I talked to Simon & Schuster about it. They're not even interested in putting out a new 25-year anniversary without the movie. So I'm like, I ain't this a blizzard. Now I can't get the movie out. Lionsgate is, you know, pretty much in development hell because they don't know exactly how to execute it. They won't take advice from me because they never want to listen to the authors, you know what I mean? Unless you have a good producer who wants to pull the authors in, which is smart to do. But yeah, a lot of times, man, this daggone weight, you know what I mean, it's killing it. So now I got to come up with other material that can excite people, hopefully, as I continue to do things. I feel like my property is being held hostage now, and there's nothing you can do because they are putting the money up or they've already paid for the rights to have it, and it's like time just going past me, like, wow. And so that happens to a lot of black books that, you know, have not had a chance to, you know, make it to the silver screen. It's a sad issue, but that's what we have to deal with when we don't have the money from our own community to make the things happen for ourselves.
And I think that's important to know, because a lot of people, a lot of fans that are interested in the stories from you, they think you're just not trying to create it, or they think that you might just be on like a vacation somewhere. So I'm happy that you touched on it, that you are interested in doing these things with your literature and making more work, but sometimes you're not able to do so because of like the constraints that are like above or out of your control.
Well, you know, when you talk about marketing, you know, we had an engine. That's what I talked about earlier. We had superstars. We had an engine where we knew when we come out, we're going to shut the bookstore down. Like, and so I had the month of August, and Eric Jerome Dickey had the month of July, and, you know, Evelyn Harris had the month of May. And so we knew when we tour, we're going to lock it in. Now you don't have that power. You got, you know, social media and Facebook where people are not interested in you like that anymore. And you got the rap guys and, you know, the app. Like, now you got social media stars, people that's just known for gossiping on social media. And so that's taken away a lot of the shine and energy from these authors that used to have some of that shine for actual writing stories about the black culture. And so, yeah, man, after a while, it's like, man, we can't get that same, and it's not as exciting when you try to drum up that same support. But now it's like, oh, Mar, we're over you. You're so last year. You're so 10 years ago. And there's nothing you can do about that. And now you look in the mirror, you got gray hairs, you're older. Now the young people are taking over. But they're not doing it with really books. They're doing it with music and social media and other things. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So now you're looking at it like, wow, how can I compete with these new young people? And they're not interested in books like that. They're not interested in our stories in that format. Now they want to put it in short video skits and stuff that they can put on YouTube, you know? So it's like, wow, how can we compete with that? And that's just the new world. So I'm actually working on a book called Social right now about another young girl caught up in the social social media thing, who's multi-talented, and the lack of attention to details that they have, and the lack of patience that they have. So everything is fast, right in your face, right now, and I'm even writing it in that format where it's a first-person narrative from the girl, where you feel like, wow, everything is moving. This girl is really thinking fast. That's how they are now. Everything is right now. And so I'm writing a book that way, where you feel like you're on Ritalin, you know, you need to slow down. So I'm like, what the heck is going on? And so you write it that way. So I can't wait to put this out. Mm-hmm. And I'm working on this book to finish it this summer so I can put it out and have a fall tour. But here's what's happening again. Will I be able to compete against the Cardi B's of the world and, you know, all the things that are hyper and the dance moves and stuff that take up all the attention? Will they hear anything I have to say from the book world, from that perspective? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're all competing with now as authors.
Mm-hmm. So your new work, because, I mean, obviously that you have new things that are coming out, new business ventures and new books, because I saw the American Disease that you have out now. So how do you, like, what is going to be the future for, like, the next year? You said social. So is there any other work? I guess now it's time to plug what you want to plug that you have coming up. And how have you stayed motivated? Because you said a lot of things that I think everybody faces, and not just the book world, but like in any industry, you're competing against social media, you're competing against the internet, and you're competing against, you know, just the attention. You're not even competing against each other. You're competing against each other for attention for the most part. So it's like, how do you stay motivated, and how, you know, to keep these creative juices flowing so you don't just say, well, you know what, it's a wrap, I'm not going to create anymore, you know, maybe my time has passed. How do you keep up that momentum?
Well, I still got to make a living. Like, I still have a house, so I still got a family. So unless I'm going to get some other regular job, which has been a fight over the last few years, are you going to teach writing? Are you going to, you know, so you have to look at, okay, because we used to make a nice living just writing one book a year. Now you got to do more. And so that's the impetus of me writing The American Disease, where I'm talking about the harm of capitalism, where you have to keep making money. They used to have this famous donut commercial, Dunkin' Donut, time to make the donuts, time to make the... And the manager was wore out early in the morning making more donuts. But that's what has to happen. Mm-hmm. I have to make the donuts, and my donuts is the new book, the new written material. And I have to figure out a way to engage this audience in some shape or form. And so that's where, you know, The American Disease came into play. I've been trying to get X amount of money to do films and new books and music. And it's a small amount, but I haven't been able to raise that capital from people that you figure would have it, investors that you figure would have it. And they're like, I'm not going to do over there. I don't know if that's going to work. But, and so you end up with a lot of folks that don't want to put money down for investing in black business. Not just my business, but black business, period. When I talk to a lot of black people who are trying to raise capital to start a business, we just don't have it. And yet, 2018. But then I turn on the TV and we got, you know, rap stars and athletes making millions of dollars. And you're like, what do they do with their money? And it's a shame that we're thinking and focusing so much on how much they're making when they pushing and advertising. And now they got rappers throwing $100 bills all around. Now they holding $100 bills to their ear and what? It's ridiculous. They got money in their teeth and all around it. And like, dude, you spending all that money, it could be invested in a business where you can make more money long term instead of throwing away on frivolous things. And so I said, man, I was so pissed off at black people over the last 3 years with the mentality of we are in 2018 and still can't invest in our own community needs and our own community business and our own community art. Sure, we went to the Black Panther movie and it made over $1 billion, but how much of that money went to us? It went to Marvel Comics. It went to Disney. I'm like, are you kidding me? And I'm not hating on the movie. I saw it twice, but let's look at the reality of it. We did not finance our own vehicle way, and but we paying for it and giving the money back to them. And them people are happy as heck. They can't wait to make a Black Panther sequel. But it won't be on our income again. You know what I mean? We didn't. And so I got so pissed. I wrote a book. This book opens up The American Disease, which is an e-book that you can get on Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com. It's already on episode 3. I'm about to write episode 4. And an episode, just like television series, because I got the same characters, but I started off with two characters who end up in a double murder where a friend is like, look, man, I need this money. You got one wealthy friend and one friend is not as wealthy. And he's like, yep, man, I need to borrow or get $100,000 from you so I can really start some things I want to start and get my life and my family and my business in order. And the other friend that has money, he got money. He's talking about, no, that's not a good business deal, man. I don't have a business plan. I don't do business like that. And he's like, dude, we grew up together. What are you talking about? But you hear Jews, you hear Asians, you hear Hispanics. It ain't about, look, dude, you family. I'm going to put this money down in the bank. We going to work this thing out and make it work together. I'm going to hold you accountable to make. And they help each other out. Black people, oh, it's not a good business deal. I'm not going to. My managers, my people told me. I'm like, are you kidding me? You got millions of dollars. This dude asking for $100,000. So we open up with a scene where a friend kills his friend over money because this joker's sitting there in $1 million house, $1 million cars, $1 million everything, and he won't give up $100,000 because he says it's not a good business deal. Ridiculous stuff like that, but yet this dude will go spend $100,000 on a vacation, on some jewelry, on a girlfriend. You know what I mean? Like, it's ridiculous. It is what we do over and over and over again. But when it comes to supporting black business, I ain't got it. I don't know if that's a good business situation. It's ridiculous. And we continue to do it to each other. And so the whole building of the American disease, it's like it's a disease, man. Like, what is wrong with us? And then the greed of white people, where it's like, you got all this money. Now you got Zuckerberg, who runs Facebook, which black people love, by the way, runs Facebook, $75 billion. What does one man need with $75 billion, dude? And then they'll turn around and say, I'm not giving handouts in charity. Really? Well, the only reason you have that much money is because people have been supporting your dad on Facebook. If we stop using that thing, you don't have money. You don't make your own money. People support you. And so let us stop using your devices. Let us stop using YouTube. Let us stop using Instagram and Twitter and all these devices and computers and stuff that we use. Let us stop buying these cars. Let us stop going to Walmart and see how much money you made on your own if you're going to turn around and say, I ain't giving no handout. You owe the people. And so I've been so ticked off lately, like, you got to be kidding me. But when you're in that state where you're trying to do something and you have money all around you, but they're talking about they ain't a good business deal. It's crazy, the greed of capitalism. And so that's what it's all about with all these characters dealing with the greed or the poverty or the struggle of being not only just in America but around the world right now. But again, that's the type of books that I write as a serious writer. It just ain't about relationship, ain't about boy, girl, and it's about the whole world. Even when I wrote the Traveler series, you know, it's a book like a James Bond series.
Yeah,
I wanted to discover
the
whole world. What is going on around the world? Not just in America, not just with black people, but everybody. What's going on? You know, don't you want to learn about other people? And some people are like, no, I don't want to learn about other people. I do. I go to movies and see all kinds of things. You know, so that's what I want to write about, all kinds of things. And once I've written about us, you know, I've written about 15, 20, 20 books about black people. So I'm like, hey, man, let me write some books about other cultures. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You know, and so, yeah, I got a whole lot of stuff. And yeah, the American disease it's a multicultural book. Of course, at the center of it, still black people. But it's a multicultural. I got Hispanics in there. Of course, I got whites in there. I got Asians in there. Everybody's in there represented, you know, so I can deal with that capitalism of America. And it's a very dramatic, episodic series. And I love it. You can get it at Amazon.com and BarnesandNobles.com. And that's how I'm staying active. By doing a monthly series where you can stay reading my content instead of reading one time and going away, I want to keep you active with me. And so that's just the creative ways in which we have to recreate ourselves as authors to continue making a living and to keep us vibrant in the world of literature.
Well, I'm happy. I'm interested because I started reading American Disease, and I'm so happy that you are still continuing writing. This has been an enlightening interview. I have a couple of quick flash questions. The flash questions work like this. You basically say whatever the answer that comes to your head the quickest. All right? So you ready?
Sure.
Coke or Pepsi?
Sure.
Coke?
Wow. Coke is a classic.
All right. Living in the North or living in the South?
Wow. I live in the South, but I'm driving to the North all the time to do my business. That's where I'm home. That's home. But I live in the South now. So, wow. I don't know if I can do this thing. I think too much.
All right. So, Martin.
I'm from the North.
All right.
I'm from the North.
Okay. So, Martin or the Wayans brothers?
Say that again?
The show Martin or the show the Wayans brothers?
Well, I don't even know the other brothers. What brothers?
The Wayans brothers. You know the Wayans brothers.
Oh, the Wayans brothers.
Yeah.
Family Wayans brothers. Martin.
Okay.
Watch the Wayans brothers.
Writing at night or writing in the daytime?
Daytime.
Martin Luther King Jr. or Malcolm X?
Malcolm X.
And who is Omar Tyree?
Omar Tyree is in West Philadelphia and moved to Mount Airy and became a writer who's still trying to do it for the people.
All right. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure doing this interview. I think
everybody is going to be like excited about listening to where you were, where you are now, and where you're going in the future. So thank you so much. It was great.